For more information on ancient dragon Zengate and Taigen's teachings, please visit our website at www.ancientdragon.org. Our teachings are offered to the community through the generosity of our supporters. To make a donation online, please click on the link for Just Give on our website.
Good evening, everyone. I'm very happy to have giving the talk this evening, Jeremy, who's does many things here at Ancient Dragon. He's one of the people who takes care of our website. He's on the board, and also, and this is an opportunity to announce this, has been our work leader as of the beginning of next month. Paula will be taking over as work leader, but thank you very much for all your good work, Jeremy. And thank you for giving the talk tonight.
Thank you. I kind of have a framework as to how this is going to happen, but I actually don't have any idea really what I'm going to talk about tonight. I think I would like to start off by admitting a fear that I have before every Dharma talk. Pretty much only during Dharma talks is that I'm afraid. Neha knows this. I'm afraid of saying something that will, like, damage you, damage the people that are listening to what I'm saying. And I'm glad some people have smiled and laughed, because that's a good sign that they don't take me that seriously. And that's exactly what I need. But I have I'm lucky because I have a lot of help in giving this Dharma talk, and a lot of the maybe the tougher stuff that I deal with, I can actually kind of hand off in a way of saying to a couple of people, one of them being Titan, which I'm very thankful that if I should say anything that is damaging, he has a great opportunity to speak from his practice and his experience, which I trust greatly. I'm very grateful for that, and I also have all of you listening to me to help me give this. Help me give this Dharma talk. But I don't think I self-practice like that all the time. I didn't see this opportunity to kind of hand or not take all of the pressure or all of the maybe the onus of practice to be able to share that with other people. Oftentimes, I would think that I had to do it all by myself. One of the places that I learned that was not true was Tassajara, which is a monastery that I've been to and I won't shut up about, because my 3 months there were amazing in a lot of different ways, but I'll talk about that later. But one of the things that's so unique about Tassajara is how kind of demanding the schedule is. And it's so demanding that I had to notice that I had to find ways to make it less hard on me. And one of the ways I was making it practice harder on myself was that I was watching other people's practice. And I kind of had this formula worked out in my mind that I was multiplying the difficulty of my practice by the number of people that I was watching their practice. And I noticed that if I just was able to work with my own practice during work period, especially during work period, while sitting, while eating, while resting, practice was just a lot more easy. And perhaps there's really, perhaps for, maybe for most people, I don't know if I can make a really broad statement, I think maybe there's really one rule a practice at Tassajara, and it is to take care of yourself. And maybe I'm lucky to say that, because it's a rule that doesn't mean one thing, it means a lot of things. Taking care of yourself can be working in the kitchen, preparing food so everyone has something to eat. And it can be lying in your bed because you're sick. And it can be not spending too much time in the sauna. And it can be taking a hike and just sitting zazen. It's a lot of different things. And that's, you know, that's practice maybe off in a monastery, but that practice is very much similar to the practice that I have in this life as a person holding a job and going to school, very, very busy person. And there was a time at Tassajara where I was, it was during one of those brief moments where I was having a really good time. And I thought to myself, I said, if I can't practice genuinely outside of Tassajara, then this practice is worthless. So I set out to really find a way to ensure or make a vow or pay attention to ways that I could bring the practice from Tassajara down to here and ensure that I was genuinely practicing, even though the circumstances were very, very, very different. And so I think one of the ways that I did that was to take this idea of taking care of myself home. And I think it's easy for me to talk about it as it relates to the Zendo. And the Zendo, this Zendo in particular, is molded by a lot of different influences, but one big influence I think you guys will all agree with is it's molded by the Soto Zen influence and the history that goes along with that. And there are a lot of forms that we do here that are maybe in your practice you maybe felt they were silly or unnecessary or whatever. But all these forms, as ancient as they are really there to create a space for us to all take care of ourselves. When, you know, just a little bit ago we were all sitting zazen, and I had complete faith that Hogetsu was going to hit the bell. And I didn't have to worry about that. I could hand off this burden off to the Doan to say, I can't sit forever. I need someone to tell me, you know, when it's time to get up and do something else. And so I can just sit there and take care of myself. And you know, during work period, and I'm exiting as work leader, and I kind of wanted to say this earlier, but I'll say it now, and hopefully Paula will benefit from this, and hopefully you guys will benefit from this too, and if it's just hogwash, forget about it. But you know, during work period, I encourage all of you to have faith in the work leader and do your jobs completely. You know, if it's your job to clean the mats, that's your job. That's it. That's all you have to do. You just have to take care of yourself doing that. And if you pass by the window and it's a little streaky, it's the window streaky. And, you know, it sounds simple, but for me it's been liberating. Because I wanted to take on a lot of different things when I was not ready to do that. And what was liberating for me was to realize that I didn't have to do these things. I just had to do my job. I just had to take care of the mats or take care of the windows or just take care of being work leader as best as I could. So yeah, that was something I wanted to say. But maybe moving on to something else. I haven't really been able to be here as work leader because I've been so busy. As you'll notice, I'm actually not wearing my raka suit today. And there's two people that I'd like to apologize to, Ortaigen and Hogetsu. So I'm sorry. I came straight from work and I totally forgot it today. But you know... Yeah, so I'm going to actually read something from the Diamond Sutra. It's a sutra I don't know if we talk about a lot here, but it's definitely something that's included in our rich history and our canon. It's kind of like a dialogue between. I hope I pronounce his name right. I'm very much an English speaker first, so you're going to hear it. Sabutai.
Help me. Sabuti.
Sabuti. See? And rely on Taigen to help me. So Sabuti and the Buddha are having this conversation back and forth. And the Diamond Sutra, maybe I should preface this a little bit. Diamond Sutra, I think to myself historically and to others, sounds paradoxical because of the language that's used. But I think in my experience, I don't agree with that. It's very rich, and there is absolutely no way I can convey that to you because it's just it's something that you guys have to do for yourselves. But I'll try my best to talk about the Diamond Sutra. And just a little bit of it. I'm not going to read the whole thing. I just want to read section 10. It's a little section. There's not much to it. But I'm sorry. There's a lot to it. There's just not a lot of words. So it starts off. I'm going to mispronounce his name again. The Buddha and...
Sabuti,
thank you. In ancient times, when the Tathagata the Buddha asked Sabuti, in ancient times, when the Tathagata practiced under Buddha Dipakanara, did he attain anything? Sabuti answered, no, world-honored one. In ancient times, when the Tathagata was practicing under Buddha Dipakanara, thank you, he did not attain anything. What do you think, Sabuti? Does a bodhisattva create a serene and beautiful Buddha field? No, world-honored one. Why? To create a serene and beautiful Buddha field, it is not, in fact, creating a serene and beautiful Buddha field. Let me read that again, because this stuff's going to happen a lot in the Diamond Sutra. He says, no, world-honored one. Why? To create a serene and beautiful Buddha field is not, in fact, creating a serene and beautiful Buddha field. That is why it is called creating a serene and beautiful Buddha field. Okay. I'll read some of these again, so don't worry. The Buddha said, so Sabuti, all the Bodhisattva Mahasattvas should give rise to a pure and clear intention in this spirit. When they give rise to this intention, they should not rely on forms, sounds, smells, tastes, tactile objects, or objects of mind. They should give rise to an intention with their minds, not dwelling anywhere. Sabuti, if there were someone with a body as big as Mount Sumeru, would you say that he was a large body? His was a large body? Sabuti answered, yes, world honored one, very large. Why? What the Tathagata says is not a large body that is known as a large body. Let me take a quick break here. So, more on the subject, and just to remind maybe myself why I'm saying this, is that I think when I'm busiest, I think that, or when I have a lot of things going on, I think that I'm not able to practice genuinely because I can't sit zazen as much as I can. And even when I do sit zazen, it feels like I'm catching my breath because I'm working so hard. I've been able to convince myself that waking up half an hour early just to sit is a really good idea, and I think that it is a good idea. But it's also these past couple weeks has been the only time I've been able to kind of just like stop and not do anything else. And so I kind of have this comparison going on in my mind about what is genuine practice, and I'm comparing what I'm doing now to what I did in the past. And when I do that kind of thing, it makes practice very, very difficult because I think that practice should be a certain way. The difficulty only comes when I think it should be one way or it should be a way that's different than it is right now. So I ask myself, I ask myself at Tassahara and I ask myself now, how can I genuinely practice? how can I practice when I think I have no time to practice, when I'm always doing something other than sitting zazen or reading sutras or not coming to ADCG. And I think the Diamond Sutra offers me a little bit of help. And the part I would like to focus on is this part where it kind of, hopefully you guys remember a little bit of what was said. Hopefully I do too. The part starts off with, it says, the Buddha said, "So Subhuti, all the Bodhisattva Mahasattvas should give rise to a pure and clear intention in this spirit. When they give rise to this intention, they should not rely on forms, sounds, smells, tastes, tactile objects, or objects of mind." I think one of the great insights into my own practice at Tassajara came when I realized that the way I felt about the day was very dependent on how the day was going and how the previous day was going. And when practice started to slow down, I could see how much that was changing and how my feelings about the days would change just based on how I felt about the day. And when I could see that my feelings were changing about the day within the same day, many different times, depending on what I was doing, kind of was able to have this insight of maybe I shouldn't rely on these feelings about the day. Maybe I shouldn't rely so much on how I feel about this moment as an indication of how things are. And I think that this one little passage when he says, when they give rise to this intention, they should not rely on forms, sounds, smells, tastes, tactile objects, or objects of mind, that really speaks to this experience of, you know, feeling, not believing the feelings, I guess, maybe, or not relying on them. Greg Fing would say during Dokusan sometimes, I hope it's okay if I repeat this because he said it a lot, but he would say, don't play the game. And when I first got to Tassajara, I thought, don't play the game means checkbox yes, checkbox no. Yes, I'm playing the game. No, I'm not playing the game. But later I saw the question or the saying or the koan a little differently. And I saw it as not a yes or a no. Don't play the game means not yes, not no. It means just being with whatever's happening. Allowing the game maybe to happen, but not letting it indicate to you or dictate to you how you're going to move on with your practice. So that question comes up a lot to me, or the koan comes up a lot with this don't play the game this, because I play the game a lot. When I think that, you know, sitting in front of my work computer for 8 hours, working at a job that I actually really like working at, is not practice, or there's not practice available when I'm working in front of my computer for 8 hours. It's just that the practice is different. For me today, I had to ask for help from one of my coworkers, so I'm new there, and I had to ask him some very basic questions. I call myself a software engineer. That doesn't really mean much. I'm more of like a developer, and that also doesn't mean much. And maybe one thing that non-software engineering people don't know about software engineers is we don't know a lot. Actually, we don't know very much, and we're very afraid that everyone's going to find out that we don't know anything. So I was sitting with this guy, and he was great. But I was nervous, so nervous. I was sweating a little bit. And he was just, you know, very nice and showing me, you know, what was going on. And I caught myself being very concerned about what he thought of me. And then I said, oh my God, I'm playing the game. And I kept sweating and I kept being nervous. But for me, like, that's the meat of the practice, is realizing that, I'm taking part in this game. I think that he's going to find something out about me, and it's just going to destroy me, and it's just going to be terrible. And everyone at work is going to see me differently. They're going to see me for the fraud I am, which maybe might not be such a bad thing. But, for me, continuing to sweat and be nervous and realize that, okay, this is just what's happening right now, that's, to me, that's liberation. Mm-hmm. And I don't know if you guys can, if you guys feel the same way about these things, and I don't know if that's possible. And I think one of the things that's been so wonderful for me to realize is that you all are so unique, and that you all could, write manuals for how to practice as you, and it would make maybe a little bit of sense to me, but it wouldn't be my manual practice. One thing I wanted to say, maybe to close a little bit, we read something, we chanted something from our ancestor Sekito. Sekito is one of my favorites. I feel like whenever I'm chanting or reading something about something that Sekito's wrote, I feel like it's like a love note to humanity. It's just like he's just telling me, or he's kind of dictating me. I don't know how to say it. It's just like his practice is coming forth through the words, and he's just like, he didn't have to say it, but he took the time to write it down. So every time I read Sekito, I love it. But just a couple of lines to see if I can pick these out again, because I kind of forgot what I was going to say. But when it was completed, fresh weeds appeared. Now it's been lived in, covered by weeds. The person in the hut lives here calmly, not stuck to inside, outside, or in between. Places worldly people live, he doesn't live. Realms worldly people love, she doesn't love. Though the hut is small, it includes the entire world. In 10 feet square, an old man illumines forms in their nature. Perishable or not, the original master is present. Not dwelling south or north, east or west, firmly based on steadiness, it can't be surpassed. Just sitting with head covered, all things are at rest. Thus this mountain monk doesn't understand at all. Living here, he no longer works to get free. Who would proudly arrange seats, trying to entice guests? Turn around the light to shine within, then just return. The vast inconceivable source can't be faced or turned away from. Meet the ancestral teachers. Be familiar with their instructions. Bind grasses to build a hut, and don't give up. Let go of hundreds of years and relax completely. So, thank you, everyone.
Could you say something about any one of those lines and how it is for you? The song of the grass. Huh?
Oh, just read. Yeah. I actually almost started tearing up a little bit as I was reading it. I always love when people tear up to things that I don't tear up to, because it just kind of shows. It just kind of shows me that I am so different from other people, and it kind of makes me appreciate it. Appreciate these differences. Now it's been lived in, covered by weeds. So when it was completed, fresh weeds appeared. Now it's been lived in, covered by weeds. I think that line to me is kind of, it feels like it's my life. It feels like, I create things and they go their own ways and weeds appear. And yet I do my best to stay present in this hut. And the person in this hut, lives here calmly, not stuck to inside, outside, or in between. And just seeing those weeds or the hut as it's decaying or changing going into something else and just sitting or standing or walking or sitting in front of my computer for 8 hours and just abiding in the non-abiding hut.
Thank you. Thank you. So, comments or questions for Jeremy, anyone, please?
Sutra again about not relying on, you know, sense objects, basically.
Yes. I'm wondering if I should start a little bit earlier than I actually started to make it make more sense. So, no world honor one. Oh gosh. So it says, what do you think, Subhutai? Does a bodhisattva create a serene and beautiful Buddha field? No, world honor one. Why? To create a serene and beautiful Buddha field is not, in fact, creating a serene and beautiful Buddha field. That is why it is called creating a serene and beautiful Buddha field. The Buddha said, so Subhuti, thank you. All the bodhisattva mahasattvas should give rise to a pure and clear intention in this spirit. When they give rise to this intention, they should not rely on forms, sounds, smells, tastes, tactile objects, or objects of mind. They should give rise to an intention with their minds not dwelling anywhere.
So upon what do bodhisattva mahasattvas rely? Bodhisattva.
Yeah, thank you. I thought that this question might come up. and I thought, you know, maybe a clever way to answer this would be to not answer it, but I think that that's not appropriate. So I'm not going to do that. I'm going to do my best to answer this question. I think speaking to maybe a little bit what I said before, I think the beauty of one of the things that is so inspiring to me about this practice is that everyone's practice is different and that everyone responds to this in their own way. And one of the special magics of the Diamond Sutra is that it's something I feel like people should apply their unique perspective and how they can apply that to their own life. And so I think that Hogetsu should do that in Hogetsu's way, and I should do that in my own way. And if someone says, well, what is my way? I would say, do your best to find out and practice with Sangha and ask questions and be patient with yourself. Always be patient with yourself.
So you rely on yourself?
Yes, and I have a lot of help from my friends. A lot of help from everyone in this room. I have a lot of help from you in many different ways, and especially with making my rakusu. And, you know, Titan has helped me a lot in many other ways.
I meant to tell you.
Yeah.
If you didn't bring a rakusu, you wanted to give them a talk, I would have been happy to have
let you. I'll remember that for next time I forget.
I had that happen in the past when I forgot mine. Somebody was like, take mine.
Nice.
It's kind of spiritual. Somebody had done the translation. Should I put that one?
Yeah. That would have let you mine too.
That would have been a little. I just got done taking, you know, or saying that I'm so glad nobody takes me seriously, and then I would have had this like brown rakusu, and you know, okay, here I am. I've got a special color on, guys. That I didn't earn. But, thank you for offering. I'll remember that though. Well, because sometimes my business gets the better of me.
But that's a perfect example.
One's a very famous one in Zagu.
Oh,
I forgot to get a bathroom as he went to do service, and he's like, where's my Zagu? He's looking at me. Thank you.
Yes.
I really enjoyed your talk as well, but I confess, I kept going back to thinking all the while you were talking about how you started your talk and, you know, suggesting there might be some potential community damage by this. I had to be careful when I was listening, just in case. Is this something you worry about when you're not giving a dharma? It's sort of like the opposite of being a bodhisattva. You know, it's like a bodhisattva does the opposite of damage people.
Mm-hmm.
But I'm not getting why this is your concern. I mean, I'd like to liberate you from it.
Yeah.
But I'm not quite understanding.
Yeah, you know, Neha says to me, she's like, you should just say whatever you're going to say. I think that's paraphrasing a little bit, but I think she says something similar and has maybe a similar curiosity as well. I think it's an old fear that stems from a period of my life, and still I can be kind of a know-it-all. And that's something that's important for me to pay attention to always. And I think a part of my practice is to take my effect on others seriously. And that, you know, that can be a lot of different ways. I can do that in a lot of different ways. And one of the ways I do it is to keep an eye on making sure I'm not saying anything. That's one of the things I say to myself, make sure you don't say anything. Because, I mean, really, it's just my opinion. But I think that the Buddha said a lot, and we have a lot of wonderful ancestors, and they said some amazing things. And I think what I try to do is try to maybe repackage it a little bit and bring it forth as it comes across my own practice. But I don't want to generate anything.
There's an old saying that in 40-some years of teaching, Buddha never said a word.
And here I thought he said everything. But
you know, my heart felt good when I heard you speak about your concern, because I have the same concern. And it becomes deeper. I remember recently I was someplace and I was watching a monarch caterpillar attempt to create a cocoon, you know, in that transformation. And, you know, what it does is it's really like kind of this weird thing. It hangs upside down and contorts and secretes this kind of chartreuse green coating. And I was watching it every day and really sort of like in love with it and its tenderness and vulnerability. And then the wasp came and took that lining off and died.
Mm.
And it really made me think a lot about practice, about how like I can be that wasp unintentionally. And that's a very deep, to me, an endless practice. And I really appreciate you having that concern.
I think the most wonderful thing that I ever did was said I'm sorry. And I've said it so many times in my life, and I'm so glad that I'm able to do it. And it's not easy all the time.
Most people don't respond well to it. They just like, don't. It's because it's such a sincere thing to do, and it's like, oh, that's interesting.
Yeah.
I wonder what happened to me today.
Did you say, you're sorry?
I said I was sorry. And the first time I said, who is this?
Ryan, did you?
Yeah, thank you. I was struck by how much you were talking about feelings in your talk. You talk a lot about feelings, and it's just that the concern or question that's come up for me, I come up for me all the time, but I'm just wondering what you think feelings are.
What, so maybe a bit of clarification, do you want to say anything about the particular types of feelings you're asking about?
Or? I'd say all feelings. What is a feeling?
Yeah, feelings are so important and so unimportant, and neither one of those are, this is to me, I should preface that. Not one of those is more important than the other, but I think beyond that garbage, I'm so lucky that women are included in this practice because some of the most meaningful insight I've gotten on feelings have been from women, and I'm so grateful that our ancestors, I think in America, I guess I can say, have really not stuck to tradition and let women talk about feelings. But more to your question, what are feelings? I think what it brings up for me is body practice and the instruction I got from the abbess there about body practice and paying attention to how you relate to space and the people around you and the feelings that come up around those kinds of things and watching them happen. One of the things I wanted to make sure I said in the Dharma talk that I didn't say is that I'm not advocating for robotics. I'm not advocating for robotic practitioners or practice. Sometimes stuff happens. You know, I could cite extreme examples of sexual indiscretion that's occurred in Sangha, or I could say something as like, you know, maybe somebody said something to you and it really hurt your feeling. And those are important to pay attention to and talk to other people about. And I'm not really saying anything about what feelings are because that's kind of by design, but I think one of the most important things about feelings are to talk to people about how you feel. That's been so important to me. It was so important at Tassajara for me to be able to sit down and talk to someone that would listen to what I was going through or feeling, and they could sit there, and while I was feeling like I would, you know, I was a fire, they were just sitting there smiling or, you know, having a different expression, having a different way of looking at things. It allowed me to kind of reflect on how I feel. And one of the ways I've been able to kind of access that Sangha practice is actually I started seeing a therapist about a half a year ago, maybe, or more. When I was a student, I was really concerned about my grades, and it led me to not really be able to function that effectively. And I was able to find a therapist that was, you know, able to listen to me, and we could talk about the things that I was feeling. And it was was an amazing practice, an extension of the practice. But what are feelings? I hope that you keep asking that question.
Either practicing or in our life, that, you know, you get caught up in some sort of idea of competing or measuring up or doing things just right and trying very, very hard. And I think trying hard is fine. I mean, I think Zen practice is somewhat, it can be difficult. But there's a point you sort of recognize where the just a huge hindrance in terms of making yourself miserable. Because you have to back off. You have to take care of yourself. Because there's something you're not thinking about that. It's sort of a signal that you are caught up in the game and are taking care of yourself and doing, you know, there's a sort of artificial measure going on there. It's really not true. Was it through that idea of watching the other people in their practice and don't play the game? I hadn't heard Greg Vane say that before in his Dharma talks. And take care of yourself. I think those are, you know, those are something to take away from your talk that I really appreciate.
Yeah, thank you.
I think maybe I said that he said it so many times because we were sitting face to face saying it so many times because he could see me. Maybe he could see me going through that gaming.
Yeah, I just kind of adding to what Douglas said, some of the things that struck me is to appreciate how much we are each different. It's really important, and we each respond differently. To really appreciate that and actually wonder how does each, you know, what's going on for Jeremy, or how does, you know, we see things differently. So that's really important. And the other thing is, another thing that you said that was important, you said it in terms of robotics, but it's, you know, part of the problem when we have a lot of forms, and maybe at Tassajara, it's more so because it's following the schedule, but you know, I think it could happen maybe even here that you think you have to be a certain way. And actually, this is about seeing how you express Buddha. So we each have to find our own way. And then just the thing about feelings, and this goes to your question too, it's not that we can pin down or label feelings. I used to say more, but I'll say it again. One of the most important koans or mantras that is for me is just, how does it feel? Just as you're sitting or going through the day, or, you know, just to kind of look at, well, what am I feeling? And not to get some, not to have some answer to it, but just that checking. So anyway, I appreciated those things in your talk very much.
Thank you. Thanks.
Jan, did you have a comment?
I was having a discussion the other day about the four vows. And there was one of the vows that I used to not say. And this other person that I was talking to had a different one that she didn't say. and it was so applicable to this creating a perfect Buddha field. Is not creating a perfect Buddha field, and that's why it's called creating a perfect Buddha field. I'm addicted to those kinds of jokes, and it's the spirit in which I recite the four vows, and I don't know why. Well, my mystification is, why do we recite the four vows when they're all utterly impossible?
Yes.
Why do we recite them? It's, you know, it's the same kind of a joke that you told about the perfect Buddha field. And it's the mystery of this and the funniness of it that makes me feel just wonderful. I don't know why. But, you know, I feel like it doesn't... I have to stop because I can't finish.